Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 5th of April, and it's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, or at least it will be in 12 seconds. And we are thrilled to have you with us. Hopefully you had a beautiful weekend, a beautiful holiday weekend. If you celebrated Easter, and it was the weather was nice. It's supposed to be pretty much in this holding pattern for the next several days, so I hope you are able to enjoy it and just bask in the sunshine that we are given. Speaking of basking in sunshine, we have a wonderful group this morning to make up our panel. We're going to talk to them about all of the stuff that's happened over the last several days. Let me introduce them to you. Alan Chartok is right there. I see him. I'm pointing to him. He's right there.
I see you through the window.
Hello.
The window of life.
That's right. Well, growing up as a Catholic boy, I feel like I should slide the window and tell you my sins, but...
Oh, I see. I get that now.
Yeah. Forgive me, Alan, for I have said. How are you?
Oh, well, pretty good. You know, it was nice out there this morning. It was 40-something degrees in the walk. It was dark, but it was good. No bears, no skunks, nothing, no raccoons, nothing terrible.
Horrible. No. Yeah, that's good. That's very good. I want to introduce the rest of the folks. I just want to take a moment to remember a dear friend of this radio station, a dear friend of this community. Susan Thompson passed away last week. She was just one of the amazing volunteers that we had, was with us for decades, and was always here, was always giving, was always, and of course, like many of our volunteers, was a volunteer to so many organizations. I know she with the Albany Symphony Orchestra. She also helped. She was an active member of the co-op and also did a tremendous amount for Capitol Rep, Repertory Theater. And so she had been ill for a little while and she died at home. I her husband Al. Reached out to me last week and said that the obit would be in the paper on Sunday, and we just send our condolences to the family. And I know she used to go. She was a very active person. She used to go. You would go swimming, right? We would go swimming at the same place or something, Alan. Right? There was
at the Stu Benn Club.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
she was a wonderful woman. I really liked her.
Yeah, very very sweet. And yes, a volunteer is probably the easiest way, but just a dear, dear friend and somebody who would stop by and bring us flowers and candy and put things on our desks and give us little special messages and was just the sweetest person. And we'll miss her horribly. And we send our condolences to her husband, Al, and to her daughter, Rachel, who were with her by her side as she passed. And, of course, all those in the community who are grieving this morning as well. So with that, we move on, but I certainly wanted to pass on our condolences to the family of Susan.
A major part of what we do.
Certainly. Absolutely. So with that, let me introduce the crowd to you. Libby Post is with us, political consultant, our good friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm great, Joe, and I, too, wanted to extend my condolences to Al. Susan was a real mensch, and I just remember the first time I ever did a commentary for WAMC, it was called I Do. It was about marriage. And she called me that night, and she said, I was in the car. I almost ran off the road. I was listening to you. I'm so happy you're doing this. I mean, yeah. She was just a wonderful person, and Al DiSalvo, her husband, the both of them together define what menschlichkeit is, what being a good human being is.
Well, absolutely. And and you know, it's tough because you haven't seen, like, we haven't seen people in a long time because of the pandemic. And I haven't seen Susan. I haven't seen Susan in the last year. And so this, you know, I knew she had been ill. I didn't know this came out of the blue, and for me anyway. And I was just, it's really hard. And thank you for sharing that, Libby. That's beautiful. We go to Jennifer Burns, who is with us, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Jennifer, it's a pleasure to have you with us. We have many subjects we want to talk to you about this morning. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Thank you for having me. And I never met Susan, but I send my condolences to everyone knew her and loved her and was touched by her kindness.
It is wonderful to have you with us on this Monday morning. And Malcolm Nance is back, and we couldn't be happier. I was away the last time he was here, so I'm thrilled that I'm with him again. Malcolm is a counterterrorism expert, a best-selling author, our good friend. Good morning, Malcolm. How are you?
Good morning, and I too want to extend my condolences to Susan's family. And you know, as a recent widower, I know the pain that they're going through, her husband's going through. And in fact, I'm in New Hope, Pennsylvania, visiting my wife this morning. So you know, the WAMC family grieves along with them.
Absolutely, thank you. Well, hey, I grew up near New Hope. Have fun there. That's a great town.
And if you walk right over the bridge, you can go visit Sarah Shartok, who lives right over the bridge
between
New Hope and...
And Jersey?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, wow, yeah. I didn't know that. That's really cool. Well, I'm glad we've had this time together. I've been learning so much this morning. This is excellent. All right, everybody, let's get started. We'll talk about what's happening on the... what happened over the weekend. And so... well, you know, Friday was a hell of a day because we had the incident at the... Capitol, and this was there were concerns, you know, what this was, but it was a guy who drove into a barricade. One of the officers was killed. The person who was driving the vehicle, as well as the person who that same person got out of the car with a knife and was lunging at the officer, and was killed. So that was quite an event. And then we go to just sort of this overall look at the Biden administration and what they're doing as far as domestic terrorism. So I guess we'll begin with the Capitol attack and what we make of that, and then sort of this larger look at what the president is looking at in terms of domestic terrorism. So, Alan, we'll start with you.
Well, you know, it's a tough road for the president of the United States. He got left with a lot of, you know, unsavory remnants of the Trump administration, who are doing nothing to help him. But the man has a heart. That's what's so astounding, and he wants to do what's right. You can tell that. He wants to spend the money. He can't let everybody in, but he wants to make it a little bit more humane, or a lot more humane, than Trump did. Trump was a guy, a divider, where Biden is a let's all live together. So, you know, I give Biden huge credit for what he's done.
So, Malcolm, let's just talk for a moment about what happened on Friday. And is this just a one-off incident that, I guess, how do you put it into context? Of someone who is clearly has issues, has had his share of issues, and what it tells us about the Capitol being a target.
Well, first off, we have to understand that's the last part of your statement is now operative for everyone. The Capitol is now a symbol of attack in the United States, and what's absolutely disgraceful about that, and that's because of the January 6th uprising. What's disgraceful about that is the last time that the Capitol was a symbol of attack was on September 11th, when hijackers were preparing to crash an airplane into the building.
Right.
So now it's turning out as a central point of grievance for all sorts of people. This particular incident, obviously this young man, 25 years old, had his own psychological issues. He had his own beliefs, but they quickly ruled out terrorism because there was no real motive to it other than what was apparently an attempt by suicide by cop. There was no political ideology behind it. And, you know, as I've said on air several times on MSNBC, a week before, that street was completely cut off.
Right.
The guy would have had to have navigated a series of concrete barriers just to get to the pop-up checkpoint. And so he saw two officers standing there. He accelerated, ran into both of them, and then came out with a knife, knowing he was going to die. That happens. But the key concern here is this terrorism or is it not terrorism? It may terrify you, but this particular incident lacks the components of terrorism.
So Malcolm, what's to be done?
Well, we've talked about this several times in this program. The Capitol security perimeter is going to have to be expanded back to where it was just a few weeks ago. And that's, it's funny because the pressure to bring the security perimeter down and to reduce it, it wasn't from the neighbors. It was from the conservative congressman inside, like QAnon Congressman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who came out and literally had a banner out front calling it Fort Pelosi and trying to shame people into removing the security protocols around the building. Now we see what happens when you don't have a solid perimeter. And like I said, we really, really now need to understand that the January 6th attack has not only put the Capitol on the map for, the QAnon crazies and the Trump crazies, but now for everyone. They've shown security was a failure on January 6th. I've joked that ISIS is very upset that they didn't know how easy it was to go in and carry out a potential massacre. So now everyone is taking that building as a target of opportunity.
Libby, your thoughts?
That's, Malcolm, I have to say that's really a scary thought, the idea that ISIS, thinks now that they've missed an opportunity. It's my heart aches for the family of the Capitol policeman who was killed, who actually was from the Berkshires. And my heart aches for the fact that we have to have this massive security, these fences, the razor wire surrounding the Capitol at a time when we have a president that is trying to be a president for all the people and to make government more accessible and more workable and more responsive to all the citizens. And yet, from a visual point of view, you look at the Capitol and it's like an armed fortress. I mean, we have it here in Albany. I would really love for those Jersey bumpers to come down on State Street. It's just nobody's storming the gates this week or next. So, it's just one of these things that as you get older and you experience more, you thought nothing would top 9/11.
Yeah.
And January 6th, while it didn't top 9/11 in terms of the amount of deaths, it certainly topped it in the terms of this was domestic terrorism, not foreign. And that's why, I know we're going to talk about this later, but it's why we need to really crack down on domestic terrorism. Really crack down.
Jennifer, anything you'd like to say before we go to domestic terrorism?
Well, I second everything that Malcolm and Libby say, but I'd also like to add that this has been a consistent and growing issue, which we all know. But we think back to when, the militia group went into the Michigan State Capitol, right? That was last April. And really nothing was done. And it wasn't the United States Capitol, but it was a state Capitol building where they were armed and they went in and it was kind of a pat on the wrist and go home. So, what do we expect, that people aren't going to elevate the game and go to the White House? Well, of course they are. That is the nation's capital. So I think we need to really reconsider seeing this as something new and seeing it as something that has been growing for a very long time. And like Malcolm said, there's just a new location that gets the most attention from that kind of behavior.
So, Malcolm, we were talking about, and Alan brought this up and was referring to it, so let me get your thoughts on this, which is the president looking to step up federal efforts to combat domestic extremism and taking the steps to prioritize dealing with white supremacist and militia. Of course, much of this in regards to, in response to the January 6th attacks. The attempts to more assertively grapple with the potential for violence from white supremacists and militia are a shift from President Trump's pressure on federal agencies to divert resources to target the Antifa movement and leftist groups, despite the conclusion by law enforcement officers that far-right and militia violence was a more serious threat. President Biden's approach also continues a slow acknowledgement that, especially after the Capitol riot, the federal government needs to put more attention and money into tracking and heading off threats from inside the United States after two decades in which it made foreign terrorism the security priority. So Alan was just talking a moment ago about this. And said, you know, that the president has quite a task ahead of him, Malcolm. So what does he need to do, and what can he do?
Well, the first step he's already taken, because if you look at the threats that exist against the United States in total as a pizza, we're talking about a pizza where one half of the pie is missing, where we just flat out refuse to acknowledge for years that because people who might make a threat or create a threat matrix against the United States are white and American, that we shouldn't even engage or even recognize the fact that it exists. And then, you know, you take away resources. The FBI was working very hard to infiltrate these groups, but they don't have the resources to do that at the time. I mean, even though they were very successful in the 1980s, we still had the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
So, you know, that's the first thing, is you've got to absolutely identify who the threats are before you can deal with them. So now the Biden administration with, Secretary Mayorkas at Homeland Security can really start taking a decent look at the fact that we have insiders who are armed to the gills. I mean, these people have driven up ammunition and gun prices off the charts because they think civil war is coming. And they're preparing for civil war. And for every 100 people that buy a gun, there's probably one out there who thinks they really want to do something about this. So the administration has to take a pretty hard line on it. But the added benefit is this actually will help all counterterrorism activities in the United States, because now you have more resources. And while you're going after militiamen, you can find out, did somebody buy ammonium nitrate? Or did somebody try, you know, want to know plans for a bomb? Might not be an American, but if it is an American, they get rolled up too.
We're going to pause you there because we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we have many more items to discuss. And we have a terrific panel this morning: Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post. I may not have told you the address. Hopefully you already know it. But it's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We love your letters. If you'd like to send one to us and ask us a question or share a concern or a thought, we would love to hear it. panel@wamc.org. We will get to those and more stories right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, we have some letters on this, many of them to Malcolm. But let's see. We begin with Barbara. Why weren't the police behind the barrier? There you go, Malcolm.
Yeah, the area out in front of the barrier is called a run-in. And what they do is they generally slow down traffic using hand signals, and then they allow – that was an access point for senators to go to the Senate office building, and they slow down and check your ID. The car came in quickly, accelerated, and hit them. So pedestrian accident with a vehicle, a deliberate accident.
All right, let's go to this, which is a question about 9/11 and can it happen again? The question is, can this happen again? I was in New York City on the 31st when the second plane struck the World Trade Center. I don't know what the 31st, oh, anyway. They should have had ample time between strikes to shut down the fly space over New York City, given that the Air Force was 3 minutes away by air in Long Island. The article I wrote for National Publication on Terrorism was called The Inside Job. We saw a possible inside job on January 6th among police. What do we do?
First off, that theory is just crazy. There was no inside job, okay? Let's just call it what it is, act of terrorism and then an act of insurrection. So what can you do about it? You plan accordingly, and then you make the appropriate changes like we're doing now.
All right. And Kathleen writes, I would like Malcolm to address why members of Congress who supported the insurrection, and especially those who gave tours of the Capitol building in the days leading up to the attack, have not yet been held accountable. I frankly don't know how the squad and other progressive members of Congress can go to work when it is obviously not safe and they have, quote unquote, colleagues who wish to harm them.
I think it's safe. The question is that their colleagues were motivating incidents. Now, the thing is that congressional access pin does get you into the Capitol building and up the magnetometers. And now we're finding that if you walk around that X-ray machine or that metal detector, you get a $5,000 fine. But you can do it. You can do it and walk in. My concern is, what if one of the crazy Congress people loses their mind, comes in with a gun, and carries out their own massacre? It should be zero tolerance, 100% expulsion from Congress if you carry a firearm inside, period.
What about the part, and Alan, I'd be interested in your thoughts, too, on this, about holding these people accountable of if they are giving tours. I mean, there's a lot we still don't know. There are reports, but this matter is still being investigated of how you hold them accountable if they were, in fact, a part of this and helping plan for what happened on January 6th.
Well, obviously, Joe, if you could prove it, and proving it becomes a big part of it, that they were part of it, they should be held accountable. I think they should be censured, and I think they should be thrown out of the Congress, to be honest with you. Remembering, of course, that we're about to have a by-election, and it may well be that the Republicans take control of the House of Representatives and the Senate, So what you worry about is that if you properly chastise them and tell them and hold them accountable, that they, in their wicked ways, as they have done so often, will turn it around and say, now it's our turn to get on you. I still think it's worth doing, and it should be done. But those are, I'm sure, the kinds of things that Pelosi and gang are thinking about.
Libby, anything you'd like to add?
No, other than I don't have the doomsday perspective on the midterms as some other people do.
You mean me?
Yeah, you. Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, you.
And by the way, Libby, I sure as hell hope that that doesn't happen. And I think that right. There's a rationale for it not happening.
But sure. Precedent
but,
would.
But I want, but I, yeah. As I always do.
Historically, it's what has happened. But we now have a situation where you've got Biden and the Democratic Congress who's putting money in people's hands, a chicken in every pot, as it were. And the Republicans are saying no. The Republicans are now saying no to the infrastructure plan, which will put people to work. So they are putting themselves in a position of being characterized as the ultimate Grinch that stole Christmas.
You know, you're a marvelous, political scientist. I know that.
Yeah.
No, you are. And what I'm thinking about here is, have you seen any evidence, polling-wise or otherwise, that the 73 million people who voted for Trump are going to desert him? And remember, because of the gerrymander, because of the way we organize these districts, and remembering all those Republican state legislatures which get to do that, and this is the year that it gets done, the question is, will they change? Will they have they come over to the other side?
And I'm asking this as a question. I'm not using it as fact to bolster a point, but I'm asking this as a question. But when you see a poll that shows that the most, it was a Marist poll, that a third, so that, what was it, 70% of, 69% of the people agree with what is happening with the president's handling
right.
of COVID and of the stimulus package. And a third of those people are Republicans. Well, wouldn't that show that there is some movement? I don't know. I'm asking a question.
Joe, it might. But, consistency is the hobgoblin of something. And
and
I can tell you Some people are perfectly capable, a lot of people, of saying, yes, I want the money, and yes, I want to do this, but no, I'm not going to desert my Republican roots. I hope that that's not the case here, but it is a real possibility.
Jennifer Burns.
Well, I'm thinking along Ellen's line here a little bit, because will these, you know, benefits and what is happening, will this jolt extremist militia groups, white supremacists, out of their behavior? Will they vote differently because of it? And I don't think that they will. I think that they're going to double down and look to continue to recruit people to their side, even if they are benefiting from the stimulus packages and from the other programs. So, you know, it's interesting with that letter writer. What I've been thinking lately about is how we think about domestic extremism. And is this, and the letter writer kind of teased this out a little bit, is it just actions against the state, like the White House and the elected mm-hmm. officials, mm. or does it also apply to ordinary people? Because in my mind, when I think of domestic terrorism, white supremacy, and militia groups, I think of both. How will groups act or direct violence towards ordinary people? And how they're attacking the state. But I don't know if everybody does do that.
Anybody want to?
Well, no. I mean, there's a real question. I think Jennifer's right on the mark. The real question here is, do we, as a society, change our basic roots? So if we come from, you know, a red state with a red state legislature, which is going to organize its, and I'd love to hear Libby on this one, which is going to gerrymander so that they can hardly lose, whether that will make a difference in a transitional poll about what people think about, you know, the COVID relief program. At least that's what I'm thinking.
Libby?
Well, I think it's all going to be factored together. I mean, who knows if all the redistricting will actually be done by the time of the midterms. I know it's supposed to be, but you know, New York, we haven't started anything, and you know, there's all this political strum and drawing going on, and I can imagine it's the same way in some other states. So, you know, I know that it's supposed to be done, but we'll see if it's actually done by then. And you know, I just, it's a midterm election where people are not as motivated to go out to vote. I think the Democrats will be more motivated to go out to vote, and that the Trumpers they'll come out, but they won't come out in the numbers they did because he's not there. And now he's saying, I read a headline yesterday, he's calling on his followers to boycott everything. Well, what does that mean? They can't go buy milk?
He doesn't want to lose again. He doesn't want to lose again.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what he's doing is stoking their aggression. That's what he's doing. It doesn't really matter, right? It's just to stoke them up, to keep them as a mob mentality, and hopefully gain some people as they are intimidating people.
Hmm. We have a couple letters here that I want to get to, and then we'll take a break. So let's do those, and then we'll move on here. We go to Bob. Suicide by cop is not a terrorist issue. It's a mental health breakdown, and I'm not hearing anything about the government pushing for more preventative intervention and or rehabilitative services. What's needed to stop these attacks is a good guy with a PhD, not a gun. Which we have talked about on the program many times about mental health and how we have to improve it, especially even with the recent attacks as well. Beth writes,
Can I just go there?
Sure.
I think you make a very good point. My PhD was paid for by the National Institutes of Mental Health, and I was an NIMH fellow. And we had to take an awful lot of coursework, you know, in the distribution of these ways of dealing with mental illness. I got a letter just this morning from a guy who said, "You don't know anything. You don't know anything about mental health." Well, you know, yeah, I do, and I was trained for that. And it was all about President Kennedy, because Kennedy wanted NIMH facilities or mental health facilities not attached to hospitals, but at places across America that anybody could go to or be referred to. What happened, of course, was that the hospitals grabbed up, you know, the money. We never got what Kennedy wanted, which were these facilities. And you're right on track here, Joe, because if it had been done, maybe we would be a little bit more ahead of the game.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things that seems to be, have been broken for so long, and with very scarce resources. And all right, let's see two more letters here, and then we'll move on. We go to as Americans, we seem to have very short attention spans regarding violence. For instance, whatever happened to the investigation into the domestic terrorist who blew up his van in Nashville, Tennessee, a few months ago? Is anyone talking about that anymore? Have any steps been taken to prevent that from happening again? Malcolm.
Yeah, we discussed that a few weeks ago on this program. I suspect, based on what the FBI said after that incident, where they said he was, I want to get the words right, imbued with mental health issues and deranged ideology, something along that lines. And I immediately took that to believe that he had an ideology. It was likely associated with the 5G or QAnon conspiracy theory. But if the FBI called it an act of terrorism, they would have to nullify, like, all the insurance in downtown Nashville. So they chose not to. But I personally still think it was an act of terrorism.
Okay, we'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get to more letters, and we'll move on to other subjects. We welcome you, as we always do, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, and back to the letters from Charles. I think you all seem to be missing the trends that show increased Democratic voting in traditionally red states, Georgia, Arizona, Texas. The hope should not be to shift the radical right-wing side of the party. The hope is to attract the moderate Republican, often business owners, who vote Republican but don't really like the whole blatantly racist extremist wing. This is happening. So I agree and understand the letter. My question is, and Libby, let me begin with you on this, but we're concerned about the voting rights in Georgia and Texas and Arizona and what that will mean and what impact they will have.
Yes, yes, we are. And, you know, the article that we read this morning, the analysis by Nate Cohn on the new voting bill in Georgia, you know, he made some salient points about whether or not some of the more, quote unquote, restrictive things, you know, about having to show ID for absentee ballots and getting rid of no excuse absentee ballots and all that sort of stuff will really make that much of a difference, because statistically it hasn't. The issue for that bill and other bills that might be coming down the pike is the state legislature being able to take over the local county boards of elections if they don't like the results.
Yeah.
That's the real problem in these bills. And that's why we need HR 1 and SR 1. And, you know, we need a new Voting Rights Act in the United States. And we need the Supreme Court to review its decision of a few years ago, which I know is pie in the sky, but nonetheless, you know, a few years ago, they said, well, everything's fine, so we don't need all these protections anymore. Right. And look what happened.
That ain't going to happen.
Look what happened. If that decision hadn't come down, it wouldn't have been so easy for the states to do what they've been doing.
Not that court.
Not that court. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, it's voting rights is something we all take for granted until we don't have it anymore. And when we don't have them anymore, it's usually too late.
And you know, Libby, when you think of it, those changes are exactly what Trump wanted in order to win the election.
Right.
He wanted the thing to be reversed by mandate of the Georgia officials, and they said, well, we can't. But now they're going to be able to. It's a really a horrible, horrible situation.
And what was interesting was the comments about the board, the guy, I know I'm going to get his name wrong, because Roethlisberger.
Go ahead.
Yeah, whatever.
You know, but they're like, no one will have his back anymore. He's dead in the Republican Party, blah, 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 blah. And it's not about serving the people. It's about self-service.
How about Mike Pence? How about Mike Pence, who they were looking for in order to do harm to him? And he comes out and he takes this position of, no matter what that guy, you can only imagine what he says to his wife about, or his children about this. If he has them, I don't know, he does. He falls in line, even though they were trying to do bodily harm to him. Unbelievable.
Well, he's the ultimate sycophant. I mean, let's be real.
Well, sycophant, yeah, but crazy, but it just doesn't make any sense.
Brad Raffensperger.
Yeah, Raffensperger.
Thank you.
That's
Raffensperger.
Right.
Okay. Secretary of State for the state of Georgia. All right. Some more letters on the Capitol, and then we'll move on and talk more about Georgia too. Ricky said, I'm going to do the other way. Micah says the FBI has called the insurgency at the Capitol domestic terrorism. The U.S. representatives, 57 senators, and even Mitch McConnell have concluded that Trump, the established, almost holy leader of the Republican Party, incited it. So how is the Republican Party not a terrorist organization? And how can you authentically deal with terrorism in the United States if you let more than 200 members of a terrorist organization sit in your Congress? Well, there's a question.
Yeah, well, you know, this is where we get into the definitions of terrorists. The Irish Republican Army, the Provisional Irish Republican Army, which carried out terrorism for decades in Northern Ireland, were a terrorist organization. But the political branch of the IRA was called Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
And they were not a terrorist organization. They were the political representation. So, yes, you can have both parts of this, you know, and not have Republicans be members of a terrorist group unless they actually take part in active terrorist activities, planning, and operations. So we really need to back away from the T word when it's not exactly useful, technically accurate, or appropriate.
But you know what, Malcolm? I think that the letter writer knew that. I think the letter
right. Yeah, of course it did.
Was, of course, making that point. Yeah. Sorry.
But when you go, because you use Sinn Féin as an example, but there certainly, then there are these splinter groups from Sinn Féin that have certainly been labeled as terrorist organizations. So then how do you then separate them, if you will, and not look at them in that way when it does breed that behavior?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, first off, there were the splinter groups from the Provisional Irish Republican Army, is what you're thinking, like RIRA, Real IRA, and other groups. Sinn Féin is just the political body that is looking for a reunification of the North and the South.
Mm.
That's it. And if their members, you know, after voting or going to the bar with leadership, go out and do secret planning and start building bombs, it is those individuals who are terrorists and their terrorist group. Are they sympathizers? Likely, but that's not against the law in the United States. We had, I want to point out, we had a congressman from Long Island who was an active fundraiser for the Provisional Irish Republican Army, not Sinn Féin, for a long time. And then, you know, after 9/11, he was the biggest rabble rouser against Al-Qaeda. So, you know, this thing cuts both ways, but you got to draw the line at where acts and conspiracies start.
And I keep thinking about our own Richie Neal, my congressman in the 1st District, and who has been instrumental in bringing both sides together, you know, in this whole Irish conciliation that we've had, reconciliation that we had. If you didn't agree that both sides should have stature and some prestige, you could never have achieved what was done there. Extraordinary. And, sometimes you have to do things you might not like to.
I have to say there's a brilliant TV show on called Bloodlands, which is a three-part series on Acorn. It was from BBC One. It's a scripted drama, but it's about... It takes place in Belfast currently, looking back 20 years and some of what happened after, right around the agreement to end the Troubles, and it's really good.
How do you find those things, Joe? You're telling us about them.
This is on Acorn, and if you can,
don't know what Acorn is,
it's a British TV streaming service. Mm-hmm. So, but if you just put it into your the Bloodlands. Into your Google search, you can find it.
Thanks for telling us.
It's really good for whatever it's worth. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
So along the lines of what this letter writer wrote, so would some of these congressmen and elected officials and others make it on the domestic extremist list?
Oh, good question.
Because if they're not terrorists. But Biden's administration is going to look to, revamp Homeland Security and national security in this way. Would these people be on the watch list as they redesign it for domestic extremism?
Yeah.
Great question. Malcolm.
Yeah. The T word is the E word. OK, so when we say domestic extremists, we're talking about people that are in plotting, planning or conspiring to carry out acts of violence. It's a very gray zone, but let me tell you, if it turns out that anybody colluded on the day of the Capitol insurrection, like they were, there's a lot of questions about what Representative Lauren Boebert did, tweeting out the exact location of the Speaker in the House and other representatives. That can be considered what we say in our world is targeteering, where you are assisting people to get to their objective. That could be grounds for criminal activity and likely terrorism.
And Peggy wants to know, why weren't all the insurrectionists and invaders at our Capitol on January 6th arrested on that day? Why were they let go in the first place?
Yeah, only 41 arrests on that day, because we're going to figure this out too in the National Commission that they're going to have to investigate this. Who inside the Capitol, there were policemen who were clearly authorized to let them in and just make sure they didn't do any damage.
Right.
We saw policemen literally go from fighting and then step back and open the doors. Somebody in higher echelon did that. Same thing with, the people who were allowed to flow out. Their objective apparently was to clear the place as opposed to make arrests. And of those 41 arrests, 36 were done by Capitol Police for curfew violations. FBI has already arrested 350 people who attacked the building, and we're just getting started.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have our wonderful panel this morning. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and if you the password to get in, T word is the E word. That's what I've learned from Malcolm. T word is the E word. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Monday morning. Libby Post, Malcolm Nance, and Jennifer Burns making up the group. Alan was with us, and I had to leave for an appointment, so I was remiss in saying goodbye to him prior to the break, but he'll be back tomorrow. And so we have Jennifer and Malcolm and Libby, and here we go. We have letters, and then we'll move on to other subjects. John says, Malcolm... Joel, I'm sorry. It is blatantly obvious that the Republicans are adept at focusing on the end game, i.e. securing and maintaining political power, while the Democrats, as admirable as it may be, are focused on social programs and infrastructure, which will find them on the sidelines post-2022. Why haven't the Democrats launched a concerted effort to rectify court stuffing, gerrymandering, and other longer-term problems, which will give them a better chance to pursue their programs? You want that one, Libby?
I think...
Oh, go ahead, Malcolm.
No, go ahead, Malcolm.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was me.
Yeah, go ahead. You first.
I think that the Democratic Party has starting to figure out that the kumbaya moment they had in 2008, that their goodwill and happiness was going to bring the Republicans around, which, of course, allowed the Republicans to gerrymander for a decade, take control of all houses of government, and like you said, rule for power's sake. It is Democrats' fault. They like to govern, and they like to govern well and equitably. And I know the Republicans say that that's them. But in fact, we like the interaction of peoples and government being good for the peoples. This is where we're going to have to start learning to play hardball. We're just going to have to understand that if we can pass something with reconciliation that's for the good of all America, boom, we do it. If we are going to have to, getting things through at a 50-50 vote and get rid of the filibuster, boom, we're going to have to do it. This is a real FDR moment the country's in, and it needs to be rebuilt. So I say all resources forward.
Libby.
Yeah, I do think we need to play that exceptionally intense form of hardball now. And we do need to just take control and do what we need to do, because we do like to govern and we do want government to serve the people, not just the few. And people aren't going to come to the table. The Republicans aren't going to come to the table with goodwill. So we have to just do what needs to be done to maintain our majorities and within the law. I'm not saying we should do what some other people have done and try to break the law or break the law to maintain their power. But we have to do what we need to do. And I agree. I think the filibuster, while it will make the Senate no different, supposedly, than the House of Representatives, although it's still a smaller body with longer terms, I think the filibuster has to go because it's undemocratic at this point. It's totally undemocratic and not in that party way, but in that general way of we live in a democracy and things like that. We have to play hardball.
Jennifer Burns.
I agree. I think what's happening here is Democrats for a very long time have remained in this toxic relationship where you continue to let the partner or the other person carry on without accountability and to just wreak havoc and apologize for them and still try to work it out with them. At this point, that is no longer working. So you have to proceed with what's right within the law and get it done.
We are going to move on to other issues here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and let's go to them. I want to talk about we've been talking about the Georgia election law, and I would like to talk a little bit more about that. There was an upshot column in the New York Times over the weekend, which I really found fascinating. They said there's nothing unusual about exaggeration in politics, but when it comes to the debate over voting rights, something more than exaggeration is going on. There's a real and bipartisan misunderstanding about whether making it easier or harder to vote, especially by mail, has a significant effect on turnout or electoral outcomes. The evidence suggests it does not. The fight over the new Georgia election law is only the latest example. That law, passed last week, has been condemned by Democrats as voter suppression or even as tantamount to Jim Crow. Democrats are understandably concerned about a provision that empowers the Republican-controlled state legislature to play a larger role in election administration. That provision has uncertain but potentially substantial effects, depending on what the legislature might do in the future, and it's possible the law is intended to do exactly what progressives fear, reshape the electorate to the advantage of Republicans soon after an electoral defeat by making it harder to vote. And yet the law's voting provisions are unlikely to significantly affect turnout or Democratic chances. It could plausibly even increase turnout. In the final account, it will probably be hard to say whether it had any impact on turnout at all. Much longer article, but I will end there. Jennifer, your initial thoughts.
Well, I think Libby touched on this earlier. It's really about the shift in power within the state government itself. So having the law where it no longer relies on the Secretary of State to be the bipartisan person in charge of sort of the election turnout information and those sort of things, that right there, then puts it totally in the hands of the Republican elected officials who are controlling the state government. And I think that is the most powerful way in which, I mean, at any point, they could reconvene, pass new bills, do other things without having that bipartisan kind of hold up here, or independent third party almost is how that. And also, you know, the Secretary of State is an elected position. So it wipes that out for the people as well. So I think that's the biggest here. I mean, and then other parts of it are almost the distractions to make it seem inhumane, to get people caught up in that discussion, like you can't bring water, right? That water and things like that can be supplied by the local election board if they feel like it. And I think we get lost in those weeds rather than saying, okay, where is the shift in power within the state here that will ultimately affect the final decision? And then, you know, the runoffs, when there's runoffs, that cut down to 1 week, Monday through Friday. That's also, I think, really that power shift, rather than it being the three, you know, the longer count, the 3 weeks, I think it was before.
Right.
Right. Because then people have to make sure they take another day off of work, or they get back out there. They got to rearrange things very, very rapidly. So those are where I think the two biggest hits are.
Libby.
Well, you know, I have to be, I mean, I don't want to say hope springs eternal or anything like that. And I know that things are stacked not in our favor because of who's controlling a majority of the state legislators and legislatures, and they're going to be doing the redistricting and all that. But, you know, I'm hopeful that what we saw in 2020, what we saw in 2018 in terms of a blue wave and more organizing and people like Stacey Abrams and women of color really coming out and saving the day when it comes to electoral politics, because they're the ones who came out to vote, you know, will continue, and that we'll be able to make some inroads in some of these purple states and flip them over to blue despite what they're doing. You know, as Nate Cohen said in this article, the quote-unquote Jim Crow, like, you know, need to show your ID for an absentee ballot, that sort of stuff, hasn't made statistically that much of a difference, nor in it seems his early voting. I mean, I'd have to look at the numbers to see what the differences were in New York pre and post early voting. But I, you know, this is all going to come down to grassroots organizing and getting out your base. And that's what it always comes down to. And, you know, despite what the laws might be, you know, people can still vote. And we just need to make sure that they do that and give them a reason to get out to vote for, of course, in my perspective, for the Democrats.
Malcolm.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting component that we use in military operations and intelligence operations, and even psychological operations, which we call crafting of the battlefield, where we shape the narrative around how things are going to happen. And I think that all of these new Republican laws that have all come out in the last 30 days since this the inauguration have strictly been designed to immediately find punishments for, you know, for the way that election went in 2020. In Georgia, the first thing they did was they gutted the Secretary of State because the guy stood up and said the election was straight. The Republicans had to show to their constituents that they were going to take control of elections again. And yeah, it may not have the exact amount of you know, suppression that many of us think that it's going to have. And by the way, the New York Times and that Kumbaya stuff, both sides does it. It's not as bad as you think. We had that during the Trump years, over and done with it, right? it's always been worse than we thought. This is designed to suppress the black vote. Even if the laws don't actually do a lot of that, psychologically, it's a message sent that Georgia is a red state. We're going to keep it a red state. We're going to take it back. The very fact that Trump lost is what all of this is about. No other reason. Now they're going to gut the structures. You know what they're really afraid of in Georgia is that we might elect a Democrat Secretary of State who runs another fair election. And, you know, I mean, they're even more upset that a Republican ran a fair election and then recorded all those, attempted bribes and electioneering and theft of the election. So the Republicans are out to cheat. And that's the narrative that is viable here. And that, you know, even if their cheating is only on the margins or that, you know, Bard College will have to do a study in 6 years to determine whether it was really cheating. They rely on that to cheat.
Well, and don't you think that some of this also is the balancing act of the Republican Party in the state? Because in the summer, they passed the hate crimes law. And then I think still on the governor's desk is the citizen's arrest bill, right? Trying to redact that.
Yep.
It's still on his desk, right? So this is sort of a balancing act.
Yes.
It's kind of like, right, well, we'll take away citizen's arrest, so you can't do that anymore because that was the trouble with the Arbery, right? Then we have the hate crimes law. That's on the books now. So we'll then wiggle our way into the voting to rebalance what we feel is a imbalance in the racial order in the state.
I don't think that they think that strategically. They used to. The old Republican Party used to do things like that. You know, Mitch McConnell's Republican Party. I think at the state level now, it is feed the rabid animals or get kicked out of office.
Yeah, but this feeding the rabid animals, I mean, we touched on this earlier, but this seems to be going to other states as well. And Arizona and Nevada and Texas, of course, and even Pennsylvania. So, I mean, there are great concerns that this will catch on, for want of a better term, and that even though we're seeing protests since we last talked, the All-Star game has been moved. I mean, I don't know if things like that are going to have an impact or not, Libby. I mean, I think about North Carolina and the trans bathroom ban. I mean, you wonder of how much impact things like that have, but it can't help, I would think.
Well, it's symbolic, and symbolism does mean a lot, and it can shape public opinion. So moving the All-Star game, Schumer wants it to come to New York, which I think would be great. I don't think the Masters is going to change from Augusta, however.
No.
But it's interesting because for a long time now, for 10 to 20 years now, corporate America has been much further ahead on LGBT and equity issues to a degree of fairness and recognizing that they just can't go lockstep now with what the Republican Party is doing. And so now there's the standoff between corporate America and the Republican Party where they used to be married. And so it'll be really interesting. I mean, Coca-Cola came out against the new law. Delta came out against the new law, and as soon as Delta did, the state legislature wanted to change its tax status to punish it. And, you know, ultimately the corporations are what fund the Republican Party. So it'll be really interesting to watch this all play out and to see if it really has an impact. But I can say that, you know, not that corporate America has been the most enlightened, but it has, in terms of the LGBTQ community, it has helped open the doors. And I think it recognizes that equity, racial discrimination, ethnic discrimination needs to be spoken out against at a corporate level. And we're seeing it in the commercials. I mean, it's really interesting to watch what the creatives are doing now around these issues for corporations. And so I think you'll see a difference. It really will come down to money. And whether or not these corporations will withhold their political support from these Republicans who are consistently anti everybody except white men, white straight men who are Christians.
So let's spend a few moments on the governor of the state of Georgia, Brian Kemp. and where he stands on all of this. Although I would also love to talk about Governor DeSantis of Florida, because that was a hit job and a half on 60 Minutes last night, and it was really fun to watch. But Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia on Saturday issued a critique of Major League Baseball's decision to pull its All-Star game out of the state. Mr. Kemp framed the battle over voting rights in Georgia as a wholly partisan one concocted by Democrats rather than a civil rights effort to protect access to the ballot as Republicans try to place new limit on voting across the country. Mr. Kemp said yesterday, Major League Baseball caved to fear and lies from liberal activists. He was flanked by the state's attorney general, GOP members of the legislature, and grassroots activists. In the middle of a pandemic, Major League Baseball put the wishes of Stacey Abrams and Joe Biden ahead of the economic well-being of hardworking Georgians who were counting on the All-Star game for a paycheck. The governor peppered his speech with conservative catchphrases like cancel culture, underscoring how Republicans are seeking to make access to voting a wedge issue that they can wrap into the cultural debates that animate the base of the party. Mr. Kemp is gearing up to run for re-election in 2022. He has striven to re-enter the good graces of Republican voters after becoming a central political target of former President Donald Trump because of his refusal to help Trump overturn the state's election results last year. Libby?
Well, I didn't get to watch 60 Minutes last night. I still we taped it, and we still have to watch it. But I mean, how many mouths does Brian Kemp have to talk out of each side of? That's all I have to say.
Jennifer.
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting here is the lead of the MLB in the sense that they're employees, right? We go back to sports and Colin Kaepernick and calling out for racial justice and how that was attacked by the president at the time, Donald Trump. But since then, how athletes in particular in basketball and in baseball have been really some of the major leaders for racial justice, for trying to help people access their right to vote again, even if that's people who were released from prison and lost their rights. LeBron James had a major part in that, setting up different polling stations or working to try to do that. Also, you know, the women's basketball and how they were supporting Warnock in the Georgia election. Mm-hmm. So when the MLB is doing some of this, they're listening to their employees who are saying we would be the victims of this kind of racial injustice and this voter suppression. And they also could say, you know, maybe I'll choose a different job. There are some people who have sat out because of COVID. And I think that also has impacted some of the decisions in these professional sports teams to look at who their employees and their moneymakers are that work for them.
Malcolm?
Well, all I can say is this. Listening to what Governor Kemp said and the comment that I made a little earlier about feeding deranged animals, it's case in point. He does not care about the impact that it will financially have on Georgia, because if he did, he would not have signed that bill so quickly. He signed that bill like the day it was passed.
Yeah,
I think it was actually passed in 24 hours. He understood that this was going to have an effect, but it's more important that the base of Georgia, white, Republican, male, straight voters, are more important than anything now. The Republicans think that money will now follow their ideology strictly because of tax cuts. The problem is their ideology now is QAnon, right? It's that, you know, liberals are evil in every sense of the word, and that if you do not agree with that, they will put you out of office right away, and you will get off the Republican gravy train. No retirement, no book deals, no nothing. Republicans understand this. Kemp understands this. So if they have to lose, you know, Major League Baseball, look how he responded with crazy Trump-like talking, right? They're never getting that back. If they're going to start losing the movie industry again, they're not getting that back until Stacey Abrams is governor. And they're terrified of that, but they're more terrified of the average Republican on the street that lost the 2020 election, that took part in the Capitol insurrection, coming after them individually.
The you know, you just think about the whole thing about the signing of the law. Much has been made about the actual bill signing, where I mean, the optics of it are the governor and six white men signing this bill that is going to have, many people believe, to suppress the vote in the state of Georgia. But then you have this painting. They're sitting behind a painting of which is apparently called Brick House Road, and is of a plantation and the home of slaves. It is really quite remarkable that it was so ham-handed, and yet not really all that surprising, I don't think, right? Libby, I mean...
Yeah, but the other part of this is that you have a woman of color who is a state rep, goes on, knocks on the door.
Yes.
To be let into the signing.
To be into the room. Yes.
And she's dragged off by two white state troopers and handcuffed. Like she was, you know, going to go into that room and shoot them all up or something. It was just absolutely disgusting. But in that snapshot showed exactly what's going on.
We're going to pause. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have our last moments with our panel. We appreciate you writing to us as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you. Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post making up the group this morning. When we come back, we will continue with them and have our last 15 minutes together. Again, you can send your letter. Panel at WAMC.org. Last call on the roundtable this morning with our panel, Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's go to the concerns over the fourth wave of the pandemic. Disagreement is running rampant between officials here. The data doesn't look good. After weeks of decline, the average number of new coronavirus infections reported each day is higher than it's been in a month. The number of people in hospitals with COVID-19 has been stubbornly stagnant since mid-March, and even as highly contagious virus variants spread, state leaders are relaxing safety precautions. By now, this is a familiar script, but this time around, the country's leading epidemiologists disagree about what to call this latest phase of the pandemic. Is the United States on the cusp of a quote-unquote fourth wave, or are we instead seeing the last gasps of a crisis in its 14th month? Most recently, the debate played out on the Sunday morning news shows. Michael Osterholm, an advisor to President Biden's coronavirus task force, said on NBC's Meet the Press that the next 2 weeks will bring the highest number of cases reported globally since the beginning of the pandemic. In terms of the United States, we're just at the beginning of the surge, said Osterholm, who is also the director for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. We haven't even really begun to see it yet. The pandemic has been cyclical, he said. Cases pile up in the Northeast or the Midwest, subside, and then swell in the South. And we're now, I think, in that cycle where the upper Midwest is just now beginning to start this fourth surge. Osterholm said Michigan's latest case numbers are a wake-up call. The Great Lake states has for nearly 50 days reported increasing numbers of coronavirus infections. We're seeing increased cases in New York State as well as increased cases with the variants. Cases are also on the rise in the Midwest, the Plains. Nebraska, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania are among the states that have reported large increases. In the Northeast, states such as Delaware, Vermont, and Maine have witnessed a similar incline. By the numbers, this latest upswing is on par with the surge of cases in July. Going into the weekend, the country was reporting more than 65,000 cases per day, a number that didn't include several states that didn't report because of Good Friday. That figure is roughly the same as last summer's peak, when soaring case counts were alarming public health officials and overwhelming some hospitals. Of course, all of this comes as the vaccination programs are getting underway and are becoming firmer in most places after initial hiccups and downright issues and problems. So what to make of it all? Libby.
Here's my thing. Don't be an idiot. wear a mask, get vaccinated. End of story.
Don't be an idiot.
We've been living through this for a year. Anybody who, I'm sorry, but anybody who's like, oh, I don't want to get vaccinated. I don't trust it. COVID's not real, blah, blah, blah. You know, give me a break already. Just give me a break. Just get the vaccination. Wear the mask in public. Do what's right for the public health, not for you. Stop being selfish. That's all I have to say. Really, that's all I have to say.
Malcolm.
Yeah, I concur. I'm getting my second shot this week. You know, this is all about jabs in arms. There were 4 million given on Saturday. We've got to beat this thing to where the level of infections, and now we're finding out reinfections, are knocked down by the fact that the higher levels of the population are getting vaccinated. You know, anyone who says they're not getting vaccinated, they're afraid of all this, ask yourself this. Did you get a polio vaccine when you were a child?
Right.
Yeah.
Did
right.
you get a measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine when you were a child? Those weren't even voluntary when we were kids.
No.
It was, you know.
No, in the school,
mandatory.
Too. You went up on that, marched up on that stage, rolled up your arm, and boom.
Nobody gave the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, go ahead.
Nobody gave the anti-vaxxers any airtime when I was a kid, right? My parents grew up not necessarily vaccinated. I mean, they were born in the early 1900s, 1917, 1923. You know, once vaccines came, it was like a miracle. And, you know, there are some people in my life who remember what it was to be in an iron lung,
right.
You know. And but now we're giving these anti-vaxxers, because of stupidity and idiocy, airtime. And they're impacting public health, and they've just got to shut up, read the science, believe in science, and recognize that vaccines are okay overall. Have people died after getting the shots? Yes. Has it been proven that it was necessarily a result? No. Okay?
Well,
you know, the fact of the matter is not everybody is going to respond well to a vaccine. It doesn't cause autism, and it's about public health and the greater.
But when you talk to, and I'm sure you've talked to them, Libby, I mean, I talk to really, you know, people that I like, smart people that I have great respect for. They're telling me that this vaccine has not been tested. This vaccine is... I'm just wondering, like, so we as a nation are going to have to overcome that. That I think there's a difference between perhaps the anti-vaxxers of old and this new wave of people who, some for political reasons, are saying that it's all a fake and the virus is worse than the vaccine or that the vaccine is worse than the virus. I couldn't agree with you more on what you're saying. I'm just saying it just seems that we're going to have to overcome that. One of the things that, Jennifer, I'd be interested in your thoughts as we wrap up this morning, because one of the things in the story that I was alluding to earlier in 60 Minutes was how areas of Florida became, because of Governor DeSantis's policies, were basically putting the rich, I mean, this is an old story, right? Those who were privileged, those who could do it, and putting the vaccine in areas where communities, and especially Black communities, could not get the vaccine, and in some cases were a two-hour bus ride away to go to, because he signed a deal with public supermarkets that became the outlet for the vaccine, and oh yes, they gave a lot of money to his campaign.
Oops.
Yeah, and that, of course, is another example of systemic racism.
Right.
That people don't want to recognize as fully as systemic racism, and that's exactly what it is. And, you know, I think the other thing here is, when we're talking about these vaccines, and is to remember that some of the research that was being done on creating the mRNA vaccine that has come out didn't just start because COVID started. You know, a year ago, that research behind it had been going on for, I think, at least a decade. So, you know, or at least since the Ebola outbreak and things like that. So people, scientists had been working on this kind of vaccine, and then here is a new virus in which they then applied the techniques to. And so that makes a difference, I think, for people who are saying this vaccine is not safe. They came up with it within 6 months. They really didn't. The science behind it had been working for quite a long time.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, the spread now and these swirls are going to increase because the CDC has put out guidelines that said, you know, 3 feet apart for school children is okay. And even with masks on and things, or in some states where they have fully reopened, that combination, especially with the new B.1.1.7 variant, is going to increase the spread. And for younger people who have not been able to be vaccinated yet. The other thing I'd like to bring up here is, like Libby said and like Malcolm said, when it comes to, you know, the anti-vaxxers now, I know for school children, every so many years, they have to submit to go to public school.
Right.
That the children have had all of their immunizations. So the question here is, when this vaccine is safe for children, will that be required for children to go back to public school?
Hopefully.
I hope so, too. And this is going to cause another uproar, I think, because if people are not trusting the vaccine already, they will not want their children to have it. And then it's going to impact the school system. And that could also disproportionately impact Black and brown communities again. One, because they can't access it. Two, because of poor health care and access to health care, but also because of the anxiety across the country, but in particular in Black and brown communities, about the dishonesty in science related to them.
We're just about out of time, but you talk about that requirement. That is a requirement now. At the first one that I've seen is at Cornell. Cornell University is mandating that all students and staff and everyone there must have a vaccine before entering the fall semester. It'll be interesting to see how much. And they're already getting, you know, they're already getting resistance to that.
Once the CDC changes from emergency to whatever the other regular old classification is, then we can say that they're mandatory.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody. Of course, thanks to Alan, and who was with us for the first hour. And again, we'll be back tomorrow. Jennifer Burns, Malcolm Nance, Libby Post, thank you, as always. Wonderful to have you here. And we will be back right after this.